Or, by the power vested in me by the Board of Trustees of Cornell University, I call this meeting to order. Can we get a roll call, please?
Divya Akiraju, Amita Akpan, Lucia Balstrady, Lizzie Barrett, Franklin Berry, Simone Chan, Zora Duram, David Diao, Karis Everett,
here,
Christian Flournoy, Allison Halkowski, Niles Height, Cassandra Jordan,
here,
Sian Kim, Clyde Letterman, Flora Meng, Yash Moitra,
present,
Suraj Parikh, Casey Platkin, Amani Arzeka, Stellar Sun, David Suarez, Benjamin Terhar, Claire Ting, Patrick Keel.
Present. We will now read the land acknowledgement.
Adam Benson.
Oh.
And anyway.
All right. We'll now read the land acknowledgement. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gaigahono, the Cayuga. The Gaigahono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gaigahono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gaigahono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. Please review the April 14th and April 18th meeting minutes, and if I could get a motion to approve when ready. Trustee Swenson. So moved. Is there a second? There is a second. Is there any opposition to the passing of both the 14th and the 18th meeting minutes? Seeing no opposition, those are passed and ordered. We will now move on to open microphones, as there are no announcements for today. And if any community members wishing to speak at this time may do so now. Seeing no community members, we'll move on to the next section of our agenda. Vice President Parikh, you have an announcement.
Probably sound like a broken record about it at this point, but I do want to emphasize one thing to our friends in the administration that are here today, our friends in the Sun, and the members of the assembly that are going to be continuing here next year. The largest vote getter of anything on this ballot was raising the student employee minimum wage to $18.50 per hour. It got 2,800 votes. So I'm not going to be here next year, but those of you who are, I think that is a clear mandate that Cornell student workers deserve better. They deserve a higher wage. They deserve to be fairly compensated for their labor. And I hope that the assembly, the media, and the administration takes that into account.
Thank you. Any other announcements? Trustee Swenson, you're recognized.
Hello. I made this announcement.
Please turn your microphone on. That goes for everybody in this room. Please make sure your microphones are on.
Hello. So, we restarted the ad hoc committee on community engagement, which means that we're trying to implement the home plate initiative, which ties and brings together Cornell students with the community members of Ithaca and Cornell at large. So I mentioned this at the last meeting, but the faculty trustee, A.A. Depew, has graciously offered to host some members of the community at our home for dinner. And I'm offering it to the assembly if anyone is interested in attending and meeting her. That'd be awesome.
Thank you. Any other announcements on the floor? Director Thomas, you're recognized.
No. So for those of you who haven't already seen it, the election results were released. You can find it on the Office of Assembly's website.
So we are now wrapped up. For those of you who ran again, it has been great working with you. Also, for those who did not win re-election, I just want to reiterate there are seats that no one ran for that can be filled. So I would reach out to President-elect Durham or the newly elected executive committee regarding that if you're interested. There are seats that do have to be filled. So if you're interested in that, that is an option.
Thank you so much. Any other announcements on the floor before we move on? Seeing none. Next order of business is a presentation from the Office of the Provost, Chief Counsel, Donna Kavarner, and our Dean of Students, Marla Love. Thank you so much for being here today. We really appreciate you taking the time. So our presenters are here today to talk about the interim expressive activity policy, as well as general campus climate. I will only entertain questions that are germane to those topics. So if you have anything to present, please do that, and then we can get into questions from the student body and from the members of the assembly. Trustee Swenson, you're recognized.
And just a clarification of the format of this, me and Patrick, or Patrick and I, decided that to make this the most effective and productive conversation possible, we're only going to entertain questions from representatives sitting around here. But community members are more than welcome to communicate your questions to us, and then we are more than happy to ask them. Just a clarification.
Thank you.
So, is this on?
Yes.
So we are thrilled to be able to be here with you to discuss the interim expressive activity policy. I just wanted to offer a few framing remarks because I think that this was designed to be a conversation, and we really want to engage you and make sure we answer all the questions that you have. So just to set the table here, I wanted to offer why college campuses across this country have reasonable time, place, and manner guidelines and rules on how expressive activity happens on their campus, and how we got to this point at Cornell University. So as you are aware, as citizens of this country, we have a First Amendment right to speech and to gather, to assembly, to address our government with a grievance. Although the university is a private institution, and so the restraints on government in constraining First Amendment speech that's protected by the First Amendment does not directly apply to us, we do have institutional values as a higher education institution that are core to a thriving academic community. So some of those values include purposeful discovery, free and open inquiry, academic freedom. And by that, we are hoping to create an academic community where scholars and scientists and learners are able to pursue whatever educational and research interests that they desire, to be able to pursue those without restraint from influencers, to be able to help us identify new knowledge, to create art, to find truth, because we have the freedom to explore new ideas. We also have obligations under the law to maintain civil rights. So many of you are familiar in the workplace. We have a federal laws around Title VII that prohibit discrimination and harassment. As an educational institution, the federal law that applies to us in providing educational programmings, because we receive federal funds, is called Title VI. Many of you are familiar with Title IX that prohibits gender-based and sex-based discrimination harassment. And we've incorporated those legal obligations in our value of community of belonging. We should expect that when we bring a diverse set of people with a varied lived experiences and interests, that there will be tensions and collisions within our community. And time, place, and manner rules help us navigate those tensions and collisions by ensuring that speakers have a place to share their ideas with people who want to hear them, that people who want to hear those ideas are able to communicate with the speaker, and that for people who do not want to be involved in that conversation are not held as captive audiences and subjected to speech that is, that they don't want to, that they may find discriminatory or creates a hostile environment. So our policies that were introduced in January really were an effort to codify in one place existing policies, procedures, and practices about when and where people can engage in various types of expressive activity. And hopefully you've been able to look at the comparison chart that shows the key provisions of this new policy with those that had existed in the past. So that's really kind of the table setting that I wanted to offer, and really look forward to your conversation and your questions.
So that was a great introduction, and thank you. I'm not sure thrilled is the adjective I would use to be here, but I'm very happy to be here. Let me just follow up on what Donica said and really indicate where I think we're going from here. We had a situation where we needed a interim policy because our policies were really all over the place and not coherent, and it wasn't clear to any external or internal reader exactly what our policies were. So we developed through the Office of General Counsel in a way in which it there were discussions with many members of our community, an interim policy. But to me, the most important thing, and that interim policy has been criticized because it was done rapidly, even though there were a lot of discussions about it and lots of communication. It didn't go through every assembly. It didn't have comments from every assembly. Where we need to go now is a conversation that engages the entire community around these issues, around where we draw lines, what happens if you cross the lines. And that's what we're engaging in. President Pollack sent out invitations this week to a number of individuals, representatives of students, of faculty, of staff, undergraduate students, graduate students, in a way to pull together a committee that will spend the rest of this semester, the summer, part of the fall, to be able to come up with a policy that we can then bring back to this body, to the General Assembly, to the UA, to the Faculty Senate, and Staff Assembly, and get comments back, and then through that, finally put in place a policy that is going to be difficult. It's a policy that's going, not everyone is going to agree with, because some people value my ability to express my views and my opinions, whereas other people are going to put a priority on their rights not being infringed upon by others stating their views in a way, an environment which prevents them from pursuing what they want to pursue, learning, etc. So that's the process that we will commit. We are committed to be moving forward to try and gain a consensus about something. It's very difficult. And then using that as a way now to elevate this conversation around how we can create a community where we all feel we belong. And we have a duty of care to everyone in this community. And when people violate that duty of care, we have a way to say you've crossed the line, and there are consequences for that. So that's where we're going. And thank you again for listening.
Thank you, Bull. Questions, points, or motions at this time? Representative Brezica, you're recognized.
First, I would just like to say that I wish I could thank you for coming to visit us today, but it took so much hassle and back and forth with last minute cancellations to even get you to be here so I don't believe that a thanks for your presence is in order. To address the elephant in the room, today student protesters set up Gaza solidarity encampments on the Arts Quad. This comes as an escalation after months of the university using their blatantly fascist and oppressive interim expressive activity policy that was formed without any input from the Cornell community and has been used as a deliberate means to silence certain voices, especially Palestinian voices on this campus. This policy unequally targets and suppresses pro-Palestinian voices. Last month alone, 30 student protesters were arrested on the basis of this interim expressive policy for merely sitting in a school building. Today, student protesters are under threat of potential suspension for sitting on the Arts Quad in tents. And I think that's a deliberate means to suppress their First Amendment rights to freedom of expression, the right to protest. And I just want to know your thoughts on this, and like, how can you claim that, you know, this is a school that's supposed to uphold the principles of democracy. This is an institution where, you know, we go to foster like future leaders of like America. And I just don't understand how you can have this interim expressive activity policy that serves to oppress students' rights to protest, to freedom of expression, to freedom of speech, while also like going there. Like, I think that's very contradictory. And I just want to know your thoughts and your thought process when people say that, you know, this interim expressive activities policy is being used to suppress pro-Palestinian voices, because I haven't seen it be applied to different groups. It's been the same group consistently throughout the entire semester since it's been implemented.
Happy to address your comments and offer my reflection. So our time, place, and manner rules, as outlined in our interim policy, operate in a content neutral and viewpoint neutral way. They're designed to apply regardless of the points of view of the people expressing their speech. In this country, our First Amendment rights to speech and to protest are not unlimited. There are constraints on all of us as citizens of this country and as people who choose to be in relationship with each other on this campus. And what we have done with this policy is hopefully begin a conversation about how we share space, how we're in relationship with each other, and how we are in relationship with the university when our speech directly conflicts with other speech, and in some cases undermines our legal obligations under the law to provide a living, working, and learning community that's free of unlawful discrimination and harassment. So I would argue, I really challenge on a factual basis the assumptions that our policies have been protected, have been directed at a particular point of view in speech, when in fact we have dealt with members of our community who've made it very clear that their goal is not to express a point of view, but to be as disruptive to the university community as possible.
Representative Wong, you're recognized.
I feel like we've been tied to this idea of respectability, not only within this time and place manner, because like Cornell is allowed to have partnerships conducting a genocide, but then you guys want to tell us about time and place. I find it to be ridiculous. I feel like we always feel like we have to come to the three of you in administration with respectability. We will ask to wear suits. We feel like we have to use kind words, but in reality, I don't respect you guys. And that's perfectly fine. Cornell, including the three of you, have been continuously shown your allegiance to fascism. Students have protested the genocide of Palestinians, are continuously ignored, disrespected, and suppressed. And if you want to know what students feel, walk over to the Arts Quad, listen to them and read the demands. Every protest has been peaceful, but you know what isn't? The partners that you guys have are weapons manufacturers that are aiding in the genocide of Palestinians' people. I feel like you guys champion time and place politics, and you guys want to say, oh, X, Y, Z, but then you guys just do whatever you want to. The Board of Trustees get to invest in genocide, apartheid, the death of children, but then when students set up camps, you guys stand them with suspension. When students scream in libraries, you guys say, oh, that's not time and place. What about the time and place for the dead children who will never experience time again? I feel like you guys have to really think about, like, what are you guys saying and what is Cornell doing? I feel like you guys look at the disrespect of it all and then say, oh, their goal is just to disrupt. Why are we just going to disrupt campus? Obviously, the goal is to have you guys listen, but then you guys are just so blinded by this idea that, oh, they're not doing it the way we want to. Because when we talk to you guys, you don't listen. When we camp out, you guys don't listen. So I feel like I just don't understand what you guys want. And I feel like you guys continuously criminalize students, then try to act like a champion of freedom of speech. And I feel like the two just, it doesn't make sense.
You can respond if you'd like.
I guess I just respond by saying that I certainly understand your point of view and the point of view of the previous speaker. We live in a democracy. A democracy is a place where people hold very different views. A university is a place where we hold very different views. It's not a place where one set of views, because of the passion of that set of views or because of how loud it's shouted, gets to essentially create conditions where others cannot pursue their own rights. And that's what this policy is meant to do, to prevent individuals, to allow individuals to protest appropriately and to state their points of view, but not to do that in a way that it infringes on the rights of other people.
Vice President Parikh, recognized.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, thank you for coming and answering questions. I really do appreciate, you know, you guys taking the time to talk to us about this very important issue on our campus. My concern is, and I'm like aggressively so, like neutral on, you know, these big geopolitical issues, but my concern is that this policy is not being applied in a content neutral way. Just to kind of highlight, I guess, why I believe that, the administration has told us that the policy, the interim expressive activity policy, is just a restatement of existing free expression restrictions that the university had previously. Last semester, at the end of last year, I'm sure you guys are all familiar, student protesters occupied Day Hall with the Starbucks, or in the attempt to get Starbucks off of Cornell's campus. They then camped across the street. None of these things, you know, had official permits, had approvals, complied with the restrictions that had in the expressive activity policy, but action was not taken against any of these student protesters, rightfully so, in my opinion. Now, this year, we've seen very similar protests, just about a different topic, right? Instead of talking about Starbucks, they're talking about geopolitics. I don't believe that the content of the protests should have any impact on the university's, you know, the way that they treat those protesters. But from the way I see it, and I think the way the majority of this campus sees it, the university is clearly treating one set of protesters differently than another set purely because of what they are protesting about. And that is not content neutral. So, I mean, I guess, what is your guys' response to that? And what steps will you take in the future to ensure that this policy is applied evenly, regardless of the ideology or the content of the protests?
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. I think what's really important to understand is that when we were dealing with the issues last year around Starbucks, and we made it clear to students that they could not stay in the building, and students left the building. We did not have students staying after we had directed them and informed them that arrests could be happening. They left. One of the things that we learned in that conversation is that students wanted clear guidelines about why can't we stay overnight? Where is it written, right? Why can't we camp? Where is it written? So one of the things that made it clear for us to move our work forward on this policy, and it's really important that I am very clear that our work on the interim expressive policy started long before October 7th. This is a need that our campus has had ever since the old code, campus code, was rescinded when the new student code of conduct was moved into student life. And so what we realize when we're having this conversation with your peers is that the desire for clarity in one place of both existing policies and practices and rules, so that when students ask us, we can be clear, that our colleagues can be clear. And so I don't think it's an issue of a different approach based on content. It really is a desire to answer your call and your questions for clarity about our university processes. The second thing that I will offer here is that we are primarily an educational institution. We see our work as educators. We don't see our work ourselves necessarily as trying to set rules. And every time someone technically violates a rule, that we move them into a sanctioning process. We offer these guidelines and these rules as a way for us as a community to say, this is how we're going to engage, and really try to persuade people that this is a way in a diverse set of a diverse community that we can share different points of views and not trample on any other person's rights. So there is discretion and there's judgment, because we really want to be able to be consistent in our policies in a content neutral manner, but not overly sanction any particular group. We are looking for fairness. We're looking for consistency. And we're also looking to take opportunities to educate our community when those opportunities present themselves.
Trustee Swenson, you recognize.
Can I just add on that? Yeah, thank you. So I just want to follow up on that, because I think it's my team that typically is in all of these spaces, having conversations with students and reminding them of what the policies are, helping them navigate what is a violation of the code of conduct and what is acceptable in a unplanned sort of protest. Or, and I want to be clear, the expressive activity policy is not just limited to protests and demonstrations. It's also behaviors around sort of speakers and interruptions of speakers. So the same sort of policies were in place and being practiced when Ann Coulter came the first time and also the second time. And all of that is bearing from the policy. But I think that there are a couple of things, and I think Donica was hitting on this, or Donica Varner, I don't know. Vice President and General Counsel Varner was hitting on this idea that every time my team goes into a space, and in the last academic year, it has been pro-Palestinian rallies, demonstrations, protests, Jewish Zionist rallies, protests, any space that they've been, my team has been to communicate, hey, here's a policy. So some of you may have been in some of these spaces and seen a one-sheeter that we were bringing before this policy came out, the interim expressive activity policy came out, pulling out the key pieces that we knew that students had questions about, were wondering about, and wanted to make sure that they were in compliance with, or understanding when they weren't in compliance, recognizing that protest and parts of protest is to not be in compliance with policy, and to then accept sort of the responsibility and accountability that comes with that. So when we talk about Starbucks, my team was there having the same kind of conversations. And when it came close to closing the building, we were still in conversation and dialogue, right? Using the time to say, we don't want this to escalate, but there is a way for us to hear you, understand what you're asking, and then you also vacate the building because it's closed. So if it went a little bit longer, that is part of the reason. But when it came time when the officers came and said, hey, this is what's going to happen, they chose to leave. And I agreed to meet them the very next morning, and they came back and they occupied the space, wanting to say, continue to say, until we have this meeting, this is what we're going to do. So that was the arrangement that was made there. There are lots of conversations, particularly that have happened over this past semester, where we have allowed some of the behavior, but recognizing you told us you're going to do 15 minutes, anything after that, then we're going to start to have these kind of conversations. But there also is, I would say, a continuing of, as you continue to build, there's becomes less tolerance, right? So we start getting more calls from people saying, I hear this noise, it's disrupting my class. And now we do have to respond to university disruption. But my team continues to, as representatives of the Office of the Dean of Students, continue to be in a space to advocate and support students and help them understand, here's the policy, here's the line that you're on. you need to make a conscious choice about the direction that you plan to go based on the policy. And the extension of, or not the extension, but the full policy was now all the full language that we've been providing since we realized in the Starbucks protest that students were asking and we didn't have a document to guide.
Thank you, Trustee Swanson, you're recognized.
Hello. So thank you guys so much for coming. We really, really appreciate it. I'm sure that, you know, we're very happy to have you here, at least most of us. I'm a big proponent of increasing engagement between students and administration. I think this is an excellent first step that you guys are coming here in person to see us at the very least face to face. And I encourage you guys to meet the rest of the student assembly members after this meeting if you guys have time, because I think that really builds relationships and trust. We talk a lot about time, place, and manner restrictions, and I think it's very important because it's part of First Amendment rights because it's a private institution. And there are 7 guidelines that I've learned, you know, recently. So I'll read some of them out. Must be content neutral. We've said that many, many times. There must be clear standards. There must be clear standards to limit discussion. There must be adequate alternate channels. So I was very happy to hear today that those students are camping out on the art squad. They did have the option to camp out behind Day Hall, which is a pretty sufficient alternate channel to express their activity. Part of the alternate channels that the administration can't say no, but you can give options. You can target non-expressive elements. You can aim to preserve respite. You can aim to, and you cannot be overly broad. So given those 7 guidelines that aren't mandated by the First Amendment because we're a private institution, but I would hope, since we are an educational institution, that we do, uphold these values of time, place, and manner. This is probably a question for General Counsel Varner, but, are there elements of the current expressive activity policy that may fall short in upholding these guidelines? And what kind of feedback have you received from our community about these 4 or 5 months, that may inform your decisions going forward in finalizing this expressive activity policy?
Yeah, JP, thanks so much. I mean, those 7 factors that you mentioned were front of mind in my team in working with campus partners in developing this policy. I just want to be very clear that there was socialization and there was conversation before we introduced the interim expressive activity. One of the things that I've heard is that people had desired more socialization, more formal engagement. And I think we've heard that message quite clearly. And as Provost Kotlikoff has mentioned, we've tried to course correct to make sure that we have a broader level of formal engagement before we finalize the policy. The second thing that I've heard is that people have shared with me that their belief that this policy is in response to activities that occurred on our campus after October 7th. And I just want to be clear that that is absolutely not true. This work is work that this campus needed to do, and that was on my office's to-do list even before I arrived here in July of 2021. It's essential that every campus and every community of learning have these rules that allow us to express very different points of views, but don't infringe upon the rights of others. I've heard people express concerns about the draft policy, the first iteration of that, encouraging people to contact us for planning when they're doing outdoor events. We've made it crystal clear that the policy currently doesn't require general registration for general protest and activities, but it does require registration for camping. I think it's really important to understand that our campus has a responsibility to everyone who comes here to work, to study, to teach, and to research. Many of you come from families, I know I do, where people come to work not just to engage in the life of the mind, but their work is a place where they provide for our families, including our facility services folks, our custodial services folks, even our campus security. And so when you and members of our community want to have events, we want to support those events happening in a way that achieves your purpose. And having advance notice of that allows us to marshal resources and support so that your events can go off without a hitch. I've heard questions and concerns about making sure that we are making that right balance between expressive activity, public health and safety, and protecting the civil rights of all members of our community. And I think that I'm looking forward to working with this committee to making sure that we've gotten that balance the right way, and to hear other suggestions of where we might be able to move in that and move on that balancing. So just to summarize, JP, thank you for offering that list of factors that did inform the policy draft that will continue to inform our work. And I hope that as a community, we can understand that outside of this particular issue, that these are rules that will inform how we can be in relationship with each other.
Just thanks for the question, JP, and it really dealing with important issues that underlie our ability to be a community of belonging, respect people's rights, and respect people's freedom of expression, right, to express their views. I would just urge everybody here, if you can, to attend Nadine Strossen's talk on Monday, this coming Monday at 5:00 here in the Cornell Cinema, so below us. She is an expert on the First Amendment, on free speech. She also will be talking and interviewed by students, and JP, I think, is one of them, who will be talking, addressing this issue of the tension between First Amendment rights and our responsibilities, first to Title VI, and our responsibilities to each other to create a community of belonging.
Thank you. I have Representative Durham, Representative Flournoy, and then Representative Diao.
Thank you very much for your time. In reviewing the spring 2024 election results, what struck me most was that Unsure was by a 300-ish vote margin the leading student response when asked about opinions on the interim expressive activity policy. While I understand the rationale for this policy and all of its legal context due to this, it's clear that many people simply do not. And there's been minimal communication from the administration just on the whole process. What is the administration's plan to communicate clearly on a large scale, and really importantly to me in layman's terms, to the student body on this policy, risks of operating without it, its contents, or any edits made in the future, and you know, what will exist after the interim is over? Thank you.
I'll just start by saying there have been conversations in various spaces that I've had with students to ask some of these questions to better understand some of the challenges or questions that they might have. I had a couple of those conversations, or a conversation with some of these members, and have, you know, pulled those ideas that now have, I think in some ways have been expressed in the new updated one, but recognizing that there are still more questions. In other spaces, also hearing sort of, hey, what does this mean? So, for example, what does aesthetic value mean, and defining that? And so I just want to echo that I understand that we have a responsibility to think through what are some of these phrases? What do they mean? How does that get applied? Who, like, for example, aesthetic value, who defines it? How does the institution define it? What are some of those? So that's one example. And I imagine there are some others, you know, clarity, for example, about the candles. So we can't do vigils, those sorts of things. But I think that there are lots of opportunities through various different programs within student and campus life, for example. But there's also there are also opportunities across the institution for us to talk about what does this expressive activity policy mean. I think that particularly the first step was to identify that document that says, okay, here's the language now, and here's what the language was, to show ways in which we tried to simplify, where in which the language was, there were efforts to simplify the language, but also still where people are like, I don't necessarily know if that worked. And I think that that's going to be a big piece of what this committee does, right? To better understand and unpack, to try to, again, as Provost Kotlikoff said, not everybody's going to agree on this policy, but this might be create the avenue for like, well, how do we then onboard it once it's finalized? And once this committee has given some guidance as to what are some things that we really need to think about, and involving faculty, staff, and students, right? You're getting these various different perspectives, and also creating individuals that can help to communicate that in their various departments. And also then what does it look like for us to come back to these sort of spaces and have these conversations and have our students also be influencers and to share what this means?
Quickly, I just want to say you can have vigils. No one's taking it.
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to be clear. Yeah. My team has developed a training module to help people understand the intersection between campus speech rights and our obligations under Title VI. We are happy to come and deliver that training to any student group that wants it. All you have to do is just reach out to my office. In fact, I did this presentation at the Exclusive Excellence Summit for faculty and staff a couple of weeks ago. We're going to be modifying that training for academic professionals. And I would love to partner, if you have a committee that you would like to preview this training and help us modify the training by creating case scenarios that would be relevant to you, or to make sure that we're answering the questions that you want. You could just reach out to whoever the committee chair, the appropriate committee chair would be for this body. Be happy to partner with you to do more direct in-person engagement on the policy and why it's important, how it's consistent with best practices and next practices, with our peer institutions across the country.
Thank you, Representative Florno. You're recognized. So, can you hear me?
All right. So thank you all for your comments. Before I ask my question, just kind of noting on what you said, I think one thing that's just important to note that a lot of times, like with our communication with y'all, it can get lost in emails, or things just cannot always be communicated the way they want to. And I'm pretty sure this goes for everyone on the assembly. We're always open when y'all want to interact with us. So like, yes, we'll definitely find people to reach out about the module, but please don't be scared to ever email us and be like, hey, we have this module. Like it's important that as representatives, we're representing the student body, but we want to make sure that there's two-way streets and like that communication is open. But kind of extending off of what Zora said, except my question has a little more to do about the rewriting of the policy and its actuality and how you want to go so much further than you did last time when you were writing it. Dean Love, you talked about being in different spaces. And when talking with students about like what should be on the policy and things like that. And so while I am aware there's a committee, there's students on that committee as well, what other ways do you feel like in the writing, in the revisions, can we get other parts of the student body to at least express their opinions on ideas about what should be in it? Should we do a mass poll? The referendum was something that gained a lot of traction.
Yeah.
In terms of just hearing people's ideas.
Well, I just want to be clear, I'm not on the committee. So I would also be a person that would be taking information that I gather from students or things that I think as the dean of students that we should consider to the committee for thought and consideration. I think there's one example of where there was a change in what was before given new context, right? And so, for example, if you take the University of Virginia, and all of those folks showing up with tiki torches, that sort of was the lead. I mean, sort of that feeds into why there was this conversation about no candles, right? Because what we don't want to do is create that on our campus, right? But the understanding of that made students think, oh, you can't have small candles for vigils. That's what I was trying to say before. And so what do we need to do to refine that so that folks know that they have the right to use small candles, but we are trying to avoid what contextually has changed in our nation and in the world, in protest matters to, as a matter of safety and health and wellness for our campus. So I think that's sort of when you see some of the things that weren't in it before, it is recognizing that protest has changed, that technology has changed, and that now we have to think about what is the safety and wellness and the parameters that need to be created so that speech can happen, recognizing new functions and new technologies.
Let me just add that I will commit, once this committee has reported out its results, which I hope will be by the end of the summer, but more realistically, probably into the fall, I would be happy to come back to this body and have a discussion and get feedback from the SA on that report.
I'd be greatly appreciated.
Representative Dio, you're next.
First and foremost, I wanted to thank you all for coming. Per Representative Durham and Flournoy's point on engagement with the student body, I think that this is definitely a wonderful first step in ensuring that there is communication on this policy. With that being said, I think it's no secret that protests and student resistance has played an important role in Cornell University's history. On this very building itself, on the plaque at the entrance, there is a plaque dedicated to student protesters acting in a way that maybe the university at the time did not necessarily approve of. And my question for you today is, in regards to this history of protests and how it has played a pivotal role in Cornell University, how has the university's previous response and the subsequent results of that response to these protests informed the current interim expressive action policy? And I understand if you're not able to comment on this at this time, but in regards to current events that have developed in the past day, weeks, what is the university's planned response going forward to student protests?
I just say in very general terms, I hear you, and I hear this a lot, which is that the history of our country has developed and we've addressed many injustices because there have been protests. Those protests, that civil disobedience, and I came up during the Vietnam War, that resulted, or a part of those civil disobedience protests were actually knowing you were going to break the law, knowing what the consequences of doing what you were doing were going to be, and then taking the action because it was important enough to take the action. What we want to get to is a point where people can protest legally, appropriately, without infringing on anyone's rights, understanding what that means, and actually in no way suppressing that activity. And we want to have measured consequences for disrupting others. These shouldn't be draconian. They shouldn't be out of bounds with the actual disruption. But there needs to be some lines and some consequence for crossing those lines. That's always been the case. It was the case during the civil rights movement. It was the case during the Vietnam movement. And that's where we need to get to as a community. The argument that there should be no lines, that there should be no boundaries, just simply does not make sense.
It's important that I speak to this because I hear this point often, particularly in the context of the civil rights movement. And one of the great results of that movement was the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So as I mentioned, Title VI, Title VII, Title IX are all titles or chapters within our country's commitment to ensuring that people have access to educational opportunities free of discrimination and unlawful harassment. So the civil disobedience that we now look back with pride in terms of the accomplishment has created a set of rules and guidelines that protect all of our students, right? And so when we're engaging in expressive activity under the law, but forget the law, under our institutional values for a moment, we should want to have a set of rules and guidelines that allow you to say whatever you want, but doesn't infringe upon her right to an education. And that's what time, place, and manner rules do for us. It's one thing to have a protest outside on the Diag or the quads and express your point of view. But when, as recently reported by a professor at Columbia, that he cannot teach his class because of the protest outside, we have an issue that we need to resolve as a community. And these time, place, and manner rules are designed to give us the framework for resolving those disputes. When I have parents and students calling to say that some of the speech that they're hearing causes them particular concern, and under the law, the Department of Education of the OCR tells us we have to evaluate those claims of harassment and feeling disadvantaged and equal access to their educational institution by looking at the whole context of the campus, then these time, place, and manner rules gives us the tools to find that balance. So the protests by which we are very proud have led to a set of rules and regulations and community values that we now must embrace and move forward by figuring out how we're going to adopt and live by and agree to reasonable content neutral rules about how and when we protest.
Representative Wang.
I just had two questions more about the logistics of like how you guys are actually implementing this policy. So first of all, like assuming that an organization does follow all of the guidelines that are listed, and they go through like the registration process and attempt to register, is there any instance in which, like assuming that they're following all health and safety guidelines, are there any instances in which the demonstrations would be denied? And secondly, as you have previously like hammered the point of this policy is to be content neutral. So given all the administrative hoops that you are forcing a lot of organizations to jump through to organize, how are you ensuring that the scheduling process is going to remain content neutral?
Yeah, so I would say, I don't know if there's a lot of hoops. You all figure out how to reserve space all the time, right? And so the way in which we do the work is the way, if you want to rent a room for a meeting, if you want to reserve a room for a performance, if you want to reserve, invite a speaker to come to campus, those rules are still in effect. And the way we have been doing that in a content neutral way is the way we're going to keep doing it. So nothing changes about when we say the factors that we consider are outlined in the policy. We're looking to make sure that the location is not interfering with reserve space or the activity that already exists in that space. We're making sure that you all as organizers and your peers have thought about whether you need security or not. Can we provide the security if you think security is warranted? Whether or not health and safety considerations. So the factors that will be considered are out there. They're not a secret. And that those are all content neutral factors.
I would just, so you're asking for an example where we might deny an event that happens, right? That was your question.
I guess like if they are following all the guidelines, yeah. Like are there any instances that you would deny a certain like demonstration?
Yes. So for example, if you were to try to register something on Slope Day, we just wouldn't have the capability, the staff capability, the security capability, the building care or facilities capability to manage both that and Slope Day. So Slope Day, so that would be an example where we couldn't actually do the work that we said that we would do around health and safety as an institution to manage that sort of situation. That would be an example. There have been examples at other institutions where they haven't been able to keep their campus safe because the organization that's coming in doesn't agree to some of our campus arrangements. So probably for many of you who are students here, we have this sort of same situation with TPUSA, which wouldn't agree to the practices that we needed to do to manage our safety and the safety of the individuals on our campus. So then we help them find, try to assist them in finding an alternate spot within the Ithaca community, or to say, hey, on this day or on this week, if you can agree to these things. And some of them are around security based on what we know has happened when other people go to other campuses, what we need to maintain the safety of our students and to maintain the safety of audiences.
Yeah, I just don't want to lose the point that we should be very clear that our intent is not in any way to suppress legitimate, appropriate protest that doesn't infringe on the rights of others. We have no intention of doing that. These rules are meant to protect all of us, to also ensure health and safety issues, but they absolutely should not be interpreted as some way to throttle down or limit legitimate protest. I think that's your major point, and I can assure you that's the case.
Representative Barry.
I was just like wondering like a bit more logistical stuff about the committee, like how it would be structured, who it would compose of, like how would voting power be distributed? Like if how would voting power be distributed within the committee if students were on it? And yeah.
Yeah. So we've gotten suggestions in terms of membership. We've gotten suggestions from all the assemblies, the faculty senate, et cetera. So that's the way we've chosen membership based on that. The president has chosen membership. The committee itself will work to try and achieve consensus. I can't tell you whether there'll be votes on certain issues or how they'll be structured, but the idea here is to first educate all of us on the issues and then try to see if we can arrive at a consensus that balances these very, very difficult issues.
Yeah, you can make a follow-up.
I was just like also wondering like how many students would be on the committee, whether or not they would be on the committee.
Yeah, I think there's as I recall, three undergraduate students and two graduate students. That's my recollection. Don't hold me to that. It may be two and two, but something like that.
And just for the public and the assembly's edification, I was requested to send in recommendations. I made it very clear that the new assembly will do new appointments next week when they're appointed. So I just sent in recommendations of everyone who I knew was running, who is currently on the assembly. And so I don't think they're going to be meeting, but they wanted suggestions before the new assembly was sworn in. So there will be a reappointment process after the new assembly is sworn in for anybody who's interested in becoming a part of that. Any members who have not yet spoken who would like to ask a question? Vice President Letterman.
Thanks. I appreciate the institutional commitment to academic freedom. I was curious, to what extent does that commitment extend to non-tenure track faculty and other employees who may not be covered in the way students or tenure track faculty are by that institutional commitment and sort of contractual relationship?
Yeah. So the way we think about academic freedom in the academy, it's really all of our teaching faculty, librarians, people who have primarily a focus of research and where we want them to be able to do their research unfettered and publish their research without retribution or retaliation. We also here on this community have a value of purposeful discovery, and we also have another core value of free and open inquiry, and that applies to all of us, right? Regardless of your job title, regardless of your connection to the university, this is a place where creativity, learning, discovery happens, and we want all of us to be able to benefit and engage in those core values.
So this expressive activity policy, once we achieve a consensus, will apply to everyone. tenure track, non-tenure track, staff, faculty, students. Full stop.
That's helpful context. Thank you.
Director Thomas, you have not yet spoken.
Yeah, this might have already been addressed, but I'm going to ask a question about it anyway. So the results from the referendum came out today. One of the questions was about this interim expressive policy, and more students said that they did not support it than support it. So I was just curious, what would you say to students who do not support this? And I think as Representative Durham said, a lot of a very plurality of students don't even know what this is. What would you say to students who either oppose this or do not know what it is?
Yeah, I think that tells me that we have more engagement to do with our community, because I can tell by the passion in this room about the ability to engage and influence the direction of our country, to influence policy of the institution, that this is a community of very thoughtful people who really want to exercise their franchise and make a difference, not only in our campus community and in the world. And I think if people really believe that, they want to, they will understand that having agreed upon sets of rules really helps to manage when your interests are in the minority, when you feel as if the concerns that you're raised are not being heard or that you're targeted. That's what makes these rules so important, is because if we can get behind them, then they apply in any situation, right? Whether someone is shouting offensive things like, you know, I don't even want to go there, but you could just fill in the blank of the thing that you would be really upset about would make you feel unwelcome on this campus, that we have a set of guidelines about where you can say that and where you can't say that. Often in our community, particularly in an education, higher education community, we say to our students and our faculty, this is a place where you may and should expect to be offended and uncomfortable because we're asking you to challenge your ideas and your core beliefs, right? You've heard people say that to you a lot. The question then is there a limit to how much, what that testing, what that stretching, what that growth is, when does it cross the line to its conduct that's unlawful, right? Because we also care about being a community of belonging. If you care about having a diverse community, if you care about equal access, if you care about feeling as if you belong and that you're seen and that you're mattered on this campus, in my mind, you also have to care about rules of engagement. I don't understand how you can have one and not the other. So to answer that, I think we have more work to do with your help to educate our community.
Are there any Representative Ackroyd?
Yeah, maybe if I could just add, absolutely. Sorry, Patrick. I certainly respect the results of the referendum. I guess I would ask, you know, what are the students for? Not what they're against. That's pretty easy. But what are you for? How do we develop a consensus about, you know, rules of engagement for the entire campus?
Representative Akaraju, you're recognized. No.
Press the red button. It's on the bottom. Like, yeah.
This is definitely working. Yeah, I just want to take the time to thank you for coming and speaking with us. I really do want to emphasize the feeling of belonging that you discussed, because again, for people to be able to express their views and feel actively a part of this campus, they should feel like they belong. And again, in line with what Director Thomas said, the referendum results do in fact indicate that a lot of people will feel like they don't belong on this campus if their views of what this campus should uphold are not upholded by this policy that's going to be put forward. And as the representative of the College of Arts and Sciences, I do just feel the need to represent a view that's been expressed very frequently to me. And that's that the putting forward of this policy is going to violate people's access to their education. One thing that I will say is that something that is very unique to an institution like Cornell is that this is a place where a lot of people are incredibly educated and passionate about world you know, things that are happening in the world, in the country, in local politics, whatever it is. And that discussion is very, very, very necessary for that. One of the biggest issues that our political system in this country faces is that there just isn't open discussion, or there's uneducated discussion. And this is one of the unique places where that can happen. And so any suppression of that takes away people's ability to exercise that. And so I do just want to express that view. That is something that's been stated by a lot of people that I do represent. But just to kind of tie up what it is that I'm saying, because I do recognize I'm speaking for a long time right now, is that that feeling of belonging will not necessarily be found in the putting forward of this policy. And so I really do just want to emphasize that students here are trying to express that they want to work with you to put forward a policy so that everybody feels like they belong. And it just seems like there aren't a lot of channels to do that, especially if there's two undergraduate representatives who will be on this committee and there's no transparency on how this committee is actually operating.
Responses? Okay. I see no other members who have not yet spoken. Representative Rezica, you're recognized.
You know, I've been hearing a lot about how the interim expressive activity policy is supposed to be content neutral. But the fact of the matter is that it's not being applied in a content neutral way. I know other assemblymen have already addressed this. But the reality of the situation is that only certain students who are basically all like pro-Palestinian protesters are the ones getting arrested. They're the ones being put under disciplinary action. I've yet to hear any examples of other students from who have different political viewpoints who are being disciplined by via the interim expressive activity policy. And you know, these students who are being disciplined, they're not doing anything that's like violent or aggressive. They are peaceful protesters. The students on the art squad are just sitting on the art squad in a tent. They're not doing anything to incite any type of violence. These are peaceful protesters who are just exercising their First Amendment rights, and they're not infringing upon the rights of other students, as you try to claim that the interim activity policy is meant to discipline students who, when exercising their right to protest, are also somehow disrupting other students' rights to academic freedom. They are sitting in an open area on grass, not in an academic building, but that still somehow violates this interim expressive activity policy. That to me reads that it's very oppressive, that it's way too far in terms of suppressing students' rights to their First Amendment. I think it's fascist. And I think that, you know, every governing body of this university has voiced opposition to this interim expressive activity policy, in that it's too restrictive. It's not in alignment with typical standards of what an interim express of what like protest policies should be. And, you know, I think that you're Dean Love, I remember listening to you, and you were alluding to the fact that, you know, the point of a protest is to disrupt. And that is correct. The point of a protest is to disrupt. That is the definition of a protest. And, you know, I don't think that these students who are doing things like going to a library and saying the names of the thousands of people who have died in Gaza, I don't think those students are necessarily disrupting people's rights to academic freedom. I think that the majority of students on this campus believe that they aren't obstructing students' rights to academic freedom. And I think that also this like convoluted argument that somehow, some way, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, where students were that was developed due to like civil disobedience, is somehow being used to justify this policy is like very antithetical to like what the policy is actually doing. These students in the 60s who were protesting for civil rights were doing so out of necessity. And I feel like a lot of students on this campus who are protesting for pro-Palestinian causes are doing so out of necessity because the administration refuses to meet with them. They refuse to listen to their demands. They refuse to negotiate with them. So in order to gain attention, in order to negotiate, they have to have these types of protests in order to disrupt. And again, I want to emphasize that they aren't disrupting people's rights to academic freedom. They're just simply protesting. And I think that the policy is just way too restrictive. So I guess my more direct question, and I would like you to respond to the rest of my comments if you so choose to do so. But also, I guess another couple of other questions I have is specifically about the policy and its limited use of amplified voice. I think that is extremely ableist to students who are hard of hearing and deaf and need amplified sound to be able to hear and exercise their rights to protest. How are they going to be able to hear and participate if they can't have, if there's no use of amplified sound? I think also another question that I have is, how suspending these students who are peaceful protesters who aren't disrupting other students' rights to academic freedom, how suspending them and stripping them of their rights, threatening them with removal from campus and all of this is going to actually, protect other students' rights. I think it's just very antithetical to me. I think you're saying one thing, but in reality, it's the exact opposite. And I'm kind of curious how, in your mind, those two work together when I think that the majority of students on this campus have very clearly stated and voiced the fact that they feel like it's very oppressive.
Let me just start by saying our commitment and my commitment as an educator and as a lawyer and as an advisor is to every member of this community, not just the majority point of view. My obligation is to make sure that everyone who comes here to work, to learn, to study, has access to the campus community that does not feel subject to unlawful discrimination and harassment. So let me just be clear on that point. Number two, we have an obligation to the safety of all of our students, including those who choose to engage in protest activity. And oftentimes we are asked to provide that support from a campus security perspective. These are men and women who have families. They're under an agreement. There's cost associated with that. And so we have to make sure that we have a community channel and a conversation about appropriate locations that fit the university's overall ability to provide consistent support and safety for all activities that happen on our campus. This university has provided a place for certain activities to take place. And if you can do that and follow the guidelines that have been outlined, then there isn't a reason to have discord within this community. We serve there. This is a large community, and the issues around amplified sound. And if you look at the comparison of our policy to the policies of our peers, it's important to understand that there's lots of different activities that are happening on our campus, including this is a home for many of you. This is a place of clinical care and support for many of you. This is a place where research happens for many of you. And our ability to have guidelines and rules about where we use amplified sound, a process for people to access amplified sound outside of those rules, help us maintain a community that is able to coexist across many differences and desires to have conflicting events at the same time.
Representative Wallen, you're next. Representative.
Could I?
Absolutely. Yes.
The one thing that I wanted to also say is, I think we keep using this example of Day Hall, and I want to just give some clarification, not that you will necessarily agree with it, but there is a clause about trespass in the student code of conduct. And so any action that was taken in Day Hall has been about that, about the student code of conduct. when students are referred to the Office of Community Standards or Student Conduct and Community Standards, it is in referral in violation of the Code of Conduct, which governs lots of our policies. But I think absent of the expressive activity policy, the decision to stay in the building past its closing would have been a violation of the Student Code of Conduct. And so I just want to make that clarification for all of us, that that sort of policy would exist whether or not they decided to go away with this expressive activity policy. That would garner anyone who was like, hey, this was a quiet study place, day hall is closed, I still want to stay here. So, and again, you might not like that argument, but I just want to provide the clarification of what happens when referrals happen and what actually is at play.
Representative Akpan, you
have a motion, 90 seconds speaking time.
That's in order. 90 seconds on the clock for speakers or for question askers.
Okay. So my question is, outside of stand-in protests, how does this policy respond to other forms of protests that, you know, harm our community? And like examples, hate speech against certain professors or alumni who are not on campus getting involved in ways that don't necessarily fit the lines of what protesting is, but, you know, harm our community in some way. How does this policy respond to that? And or what other plans are there for response to those types of protests, and what constitutes protests as well? Because we have seen so many different types of protests on this campus, or alleged protests on this campus, and this policy doesn't really respond to all the forms that we have seen this year.
Yeah, thanks so much for that question. We define protest in the policy, right? And we provide different sections in the policy. I just want to be clear that hate speech is protected speech under the First Amendment, right? So people can say really hateful things. What we are trying to do within this policy and in our policy that prohibits unlawful discrimination and harassment is look at the whole context of the situation and to make sure all of that does not cross the line to deny someone the ability to access the university resources on the same level of any other student, faculty, or staff. We will see commentary in the Daily Sun, opinion pieces. People may get on TV and say issues that are inconsistent with your values, that may be inconsistent with the institution's values. And our desire is not to have a set of rules that prescribe that activity. The interim expressive activity policy is designed to be a community engaged document about how we share space, physical space, and share views in ways that might cause harm to other people. Oftentimes, as I mentioned, we tell people you have to take a lot of conduct and speech that may be hurtful, but it's permissible in our community. We also just want to make sure through these rules that we are giving people the boundaries. That's what these rules are the boundaries. Does that make sense? Okay.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. You're recognized.
Hello. Thank you for coming. Oh, does this work? Okay, perfect. Thank you for coming here today. I was just wondering, the interim activity policy, in line with like content neutrality, as JP was saying, like has like narrowly tailored restrictions. But I was wondering if the boundaries may seem as like too strict to the point of like imposing prior restraint or undue restraint on students with protests between like 12 to 1 and only for 1 hour without admin approval. And whether or not like, I think that the discontent comes from whether or not the policy like burdens substantial, like is a more substantial burden on speech than is necessary for our institution. And I know you're talking about research and affecting research, but I know like the UA and maybe the Faculty Senate had expressed some concerns about the interim policy. So I was wondering what their weigh-in is on like the restrictions or like the imposition on research. And maybe there are some voices that we didn't quite hear from faculty. And how did you, I was less than clarification on how you came up with like the 1 hour policy or like those times that we can speak.
Yeah, so the guidelines around amplified sound existed long before I arrived here. And I understand that the source of those were actually from faculty who found that the student tour guides who give tours to, you know, prospective families, they used to use those megaphones and people found them distracting and interrupting as they're teaching. And so that's actually, it came from faculty. That's a voice. I'm trying to teach a class. I find this noise distracting. Can we limit amplified sound to one? And I think, you know, I would imagine that part of the reason is that we permit it between 12 and 1. It's lunch hour for people who want to engage in activity to get the attention of the administration in Day Hall or in Hope Plaza, which is a traditional gathering space for expressive activity on this campus, that we could do that at a time that's most convenient for most students. I would imagine that this committee will be engaging a lot around that if we can have more times, more place, but it also allows for people to ask for additional time and space to engage, like Slope Day, right? So it's not like it's all no. There are ways in which you can say, I'd like to have this activity at this time and place, and that we look at those factors that are in the policy and say, yes, we can facilitate that.
Anybody who's not spoken? All right, Representative Almeida.
I just want to say one thing I do appreciate about this policy is with the increased staff and security, you can have like a faster response to any sort of EMS needs or fire needs. So that can like really help put out a fire faster or get somebody help faster, which is something I do appreciate about this policy.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Wong, you're next.
Patrick, I think we have some other commitments.
Can I say what I have to say first before I leave?
I didn't hear what you said. Can you restate that?
I said, can I say my question first?
Do you have time for one more question?
Okay, thank you. So just the first thing, you don't have to respond to this point, but I think it would be hard-pressed to find of master's students who believe the fast-tracking and the clumsiness of the policy is completely untethered from October 7th in the protests that followed, regardless of what is said. I think that just more speaks to the lack of faith that people have in admin. But anyways, I'd like to pose like a hypothetical question. For whatever reason, the genocide in Gaza is portrayed as if certain facts are not real. So I don't want to focus on that right now. I'd like to use a historical example. That's something that we as society have reached consensus on. In 1985, Cornell University became a focal point for the divestment movement against apartheid, led by students and later joined by faculty protest sit-ins in a shantytown encampment similar to what we see today, and hunger strikes ensued, resulting in mass arrests. So I want you guys to all imagine the protests we have today were in protest of Cornell's investment in South African apartheid. Would these time and place manner calls be the same if students were set up to camp and prove what has been proved to be Cornell's complicity in an apartheid system? Because it feels like you guys would have done the same thing. You guys would have arrested students for protesting against apartheid in South Africa. Yeah, I would have arrested Martin Luther King Jr. for the sit-ins. In other words, is Cornell completely free to do anything with our money than heavily limit student response and hold us to these time and place responses? But please address the hypothetical question.
I think this question is for you. What type of expectations do you have for your peers?
That wasn't the question. I'm sorry.
Well, that's how I'm going to answer it. Right? What kind of expectations do you have for each other about how we share space in this community? And I think that's really the important question here. How do we share space and be in relationship with each other when we have really deeply different views about the world, different views about what the university's position should be on that world, how we express that, when we express it? So this is not about necessarily an imposition. This is about feeling, understanding, and gathering. What does those core values mean? When you accept your admission to Cornell, you're accepting a commitment to the university's six core values. And one of those core values is being in a community of belonging. What do you owe each other in terms of your behavior?
I think that is, I'm sorry that we ran a little over. I was under the impression here until 6:15. That's my fault. I think that's all the time we have. I appreciate you all so much for coming. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us this evening.
Thank you very much.
All right. We do have a lot of other business to get to, so I'm going to make a motion that we extend time till 6:45. Is there a motion to extend time? Is there a second? Okay. Thank you. Is there any dissent?
Motion to add Resolution 77 to the top of the agenda.
Let me just get through this current motion, then you can do that. Is there any dissent to the current motion on the floor to extend time to 6:45? There's a motion on the floor to suspend the rules and add resolution what?
77.
And what's the title?
Upholding freedom of expression.
Upholding freedom of expression as an agenda item on today's calendar. Is there a second to that motion? Is there any dissent? Point of information. I will hold this motion for 2 minutes.
Add it to the box.
Point of information. Wait, is it in the box?
Is this something you guys want to vote on today?
Yes.
So it'll be added to the third reading calendar so that we can actually vote on today. The second reading calendar can't be voted on, just for clarity.
What calendar?
So we have two calendars. The second reading calendar is things that we have to vote on at the next meeting, and the third reading calendar is the final thing. So it'll be added to the third reading calendar.
Is it in the box? Yeah, I don't see it.
Yeah, but it's the suspension of the rules to add it to the third reading calendar, so we can vote on it today.
It has to happen. Then I have to suspend the rules again to have that.
I can't hear you.
Then I would have to suspend the rules again to have the third reading calendar put to the top.
Order, hold on. Let that finish.
Okay.
Blank in a second.
No problem.
Take your time.
Okay, with that, that is in order. Was there any dissent to adding that to the agenda?
Can I make a motion to recess for 5 minutes?
You can make a motion to recess for 5 minutes.
So in the recess, read the whatever.
Okay. Yeah.
There's a second. Is there any dissent to a recess for 5 minutes? Seeing none, we'll be back in 6:18. Take your seats.
I'll be good right
now. That's all right.
Did you see that?
Yeah. Why did you? I thought that's my seat, Dora.
No, it's mine.
How is SUNY? I didn't get the SUNY rundown. I heard you killed up there. Wait, what's the...
All right, take your seats.
Tell me, I want to hear what happened.
The Voltaire quotes.
Yeah. Glad you enjoyed it. Did you get yourself? Oh, good. Good.
Okay. With that, our previous motion is on the floor to consider resolution, what it would actually be resolution 77, right? Resolution 77, upholding freedom of expression, which is now in the box. There has been a second on the motion. We will vote on the motion to suspend the rules and add this to the third reading calendar. All those in favor of this, please raise your placards at this time. Okay, all those opposed? Seeing no opposition, this will be added to the third reading calendar. We will next move into the next item of business, Resolution 75, establishing the Student Assembly Campus Pulse Committee. I did not understand that part of the motion, but if that was the motion that was made, we will address Resolution 77 before we address Resolution 75. Please take your place at the front of the room. Point of information. You can do a quorum call, but we are. I just counted. We have to.
Point of information.
Quick. Don't do a quorum call.
Point of information. It's really not important. I have David's proxy.
What?
Just FYI, I have David's proxy.
Okay. Thank you.
Read it. I'm not that good. I read it. I was going to read it. The last actual resolution on matters. I'm just going to read it from top to bottom.
And we are.
It's only a page, so Jamal is going to read it from top to bottom. It should be pretty quick. We can discuss.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Okay. So,
why is it monitoring?
Yeah. And so the university has an unfortunate and violent historical pattern of silencing student voices when they express dissent by the way of their constitutional right to protest. Whereas in 1985, Cornell University became a focal point of the divestment movement against South African apartheid, led by students and later joined by faculty. Protests, including sit-ins, a shanty town encampment, and a hunger strike ensued, resulting in mass arrests. Despite these efforts, the university's board of trustees initially resisted full divestment, causing prolonged tensions and campus activism. In fact, the initial sit-ins led to approximately 100 student arrests, with an additional arrest occurring over the subsequent protests and demonstrations, totaling over 1,000 students, faculty, and staff arrested throughout the course of the movement. This university's history established a pattern of suppressing unpopular speech, one that we as a body have actively resisted in the past, present, and now the future. It must affirm the fundamental right to express dissent without fear of its suppression or retaliation. The campaign serves as a powerful reminder of the importance of preserving and protecting the rights of individuals to assemble and engage in peaceful protests. We call upon the university administration and all stakeholders to respect and uphold the right of protesters and engage in constructive dialogue to address their concerns and grievances. Therefore, be resolved that the university assembly sets the president. The student assembly sets the president from now and in perpetuity, that punitive action against peaceful protests is unacceptable, that the assembly recognize that allowing punitive measures against peaceful protests threatens speech for all and is such a dangerous precedent of free speech expression for voices across the political spectrum. The student assembly may not agree with what students are protesting for, but rather support all students' right to protest on behalf of their beliefs. The student assembly condemn any disciplinary action related to any student's participation in peaceful protests, and be it finally resolved that Cornell University respect the results of the referendum, respecting the broader voice of the student body. This is submitted by us, then a whole bunch of community sponsors. Please keep in mind that they have this as well. So that's like hundreds of students backing this as well. But thanks.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Florno, you're recognized.
Only question I have, so the student assembly need not to agree with what students are protesting for, but rather support all students' rights to protest on behalf of their beliefs. Back in the fall, there was a time at which people wanted like the assembly to like make a statement publicly supporting an idea either which way. So my only real question is like, if something like that were to happen again, where the student assembly is asked to like make a stance on something per that clause, are you recommending that the student assembly either doesn't say anything at all or supports any and everything that is like promoted?
I think that's a really great question. And I think that it's up to the assembly's discretion what statements it wants to make. Now, I can have personal views on how I think the assembly should vote one way or the other, but I think overarchingly what this resolution is looking to address is that the university support all student protest. As long as it remains peaceful, it is a student's, you know, right as an American citizen, as an individual that attends this institution to have the right to protest. And while I understand that there will be issues where someone may not personally agree with the message that the students are saying, it is still our responsibility as student assembly representatives to respect their right to peacefully protest. And I think that it's inappropriate of the university to be punitive against students who are exercising that right.
Cool. Thank you. Representative Vice President Breek.
Yeah. Thank you guys for introducing this. Totally agree with the resolution. My one question is kind of going off what Representative Florno was saying. I really like how the resolution is neutrally worded. It is content neutral, right? It's just saying that we support free expression and the right of students to protest. Would you guys be open to striking lines 46 and 47? Because I know that is kind of taking a particular stance on a political issue, not saying that a student should not be punished for protesting.
Yeah, so with lines 46 and 47, it is neutrally worded, so I'm kind of confused about what you mean by taking a stance. It's just asking the assembly to respect the results of the referendum that students had, like, voted on.
Yeah, and I don't get why we would want to say, like, to remove something that's compelling, like, that's giving power to the student assembly. You know, the referendum reflects the broader voice referendums, period. Maybe you could make it broader to referendums in general, but I don't think we should be removing something that, like, obviously we want. We just, as a body, should want this, like, whatever. Yeah.
Would you be more open to possibly moving the line somewhere in the where as is to just give a broader context of the fact that, you know, if students are protesting because of this referendum that has been passed and they feel as though their voice is not being respected? I can understand why having in the finally resolved when the further resolves are directly about the right to protest. And so this last line may be a better fit in a contextual setting. I don't know if that.
Yeah, I think so.
Representative Durant, be recognized.
This is really small, but on line 17, I know Jamal, when you're speaking, you said South African apartheid, like, specific outright, but I was wondering if you could edit that in, just like, you know, declare fully instead of like the general word apartheid, but like specify South African apartheid for context of 1985.
Yeah, you can motion to amend. There's a motion on the floor to amend to add South African apartheid. Is there a second? Is there any dissent? Seeing no dissent, South African apartheid is hereby ordered to be added on line 17. Trustee Swenson.
Thank you guys for presenting this resolution. Like, the whole premise I'm gathering from this is that peaceful protest is unacceptable. And on that basis, what?
Did you repeat that?
Peaceful protest is unacceptable. Sorry. Punitive action against peaceful protest is unacceptable. Sorry. Not on the, take it off the record. Doc, take it off the record, please. All right. I'm sorry. Punitive action against peaceful protests is unacceptable. I agree broadly that it is unacceptable. However, what is peaceful protest? Is peaceful protest going into academic buildings while things are happening and yelling, right? Cause that is peaceful, right? Like, is peaceful protest anything that isn't nonviolent protest? You know, what is peaceful protest? Because yeah, that's my question. What is peaceful protest? What do you mean by that in line 38?
I would say that in this context, what we are, if we want to say in the situation we're supplying specifically, the students who are participating in the encampment are being threatened with punitive action that can lead up to suspension. Now, that could differ from student to student just based on the disciplinary action that they've had in the past. But I think that in the context of the direct punishment that has been instigated against the students right now, it, to your point, peaceful protest could have been students in the building. But what the response from the university was directly against the individuals practicing the encampment. So,
and also it is up to, like, like if a student is brought in for like violating the rules, then this would leave a way for them to argue that their protest was peaceful. So it would be up to the students or administration to decide, unfortunately. But I don't think we should be defining what a peaceful protest is because we're not going to agree today.
Thank you. I just have a quick edit. Line 60, Representative Rezica, isn't your class year 25? Just looking at it.
Yeah.
I don't think that needs a motion to amend or anything. I just think it should be fixed before we put it up. So it's all bundled up. Other points or motions on the floor? Representative Barry?
So just in like a perfect world, right, we pass this document, it gets on Martha's desk. What's your hope? Does she even approve this? Like, is this even asking for policy or is this just an opinion piece that we're putting out?
Just opinion piece, sense of the body resolution.
All right.
Yeah, I think it's just to show students that the relationship between our student body and administration is a little contentious right now, but I think that we're showing our student body that as their elected representatives, we do respect their right to protest. And if the administration is giving them pushback, as the individuals who are here to represent them, we stand with their right to protest regardless of their political belief. And if one day students come in here with a different belief than my own, and they are being penalized in the same way, I would be the first to advocate for them because I believe it's very important for us to stand up for students' rights, period.
Thank you. Other people who have not spoken, Representative Preek?
Yeah, so I guess an amendment in line with what I was saying earlier. Motion to move line 46 and 47 to, I guess, like after the last whereas clause and say that whereas students protesting are advocating for the referendum or for a referendum that that reflects the broader voice of the student body. Something along those lines. I don't know if you guys have any input into that.
If you're going to make an amendment, you need to have specific language. I don't want to do the guessing game. If you want to write something out and make an amendment. Other points or motions on the floor? Trustee Swanson.
I guess my question for you guys regarding the peaceful protest and preemptive action for that protest is that I think Representative Everett made a good point regarding like the specificity of my question, because I don't think that the entirety of the student body agrees that peaceful protest means you're allowed to go into a library for a long time and make lots of noise. So I would say that some people in our community are saying that that type of peaceful protest is unacceptable. I think what you guys are getting at is maybe that the expressive activity policy isn't in line with our expectations for what protesting should be. So I think we should focus more on that rather than just say that all peaceful protests, all punitive action against peaceful protests is unacceptable, because I really think in some cases that it is acceptable. If you go into, you know, a classroom with a massive speaker and just blast a speaker for 3 hours, right? That's an example where that is, in my sense, unacceptable, right? So in all cases, you know, I don't think it's my sense that statement isn't, you know, ubiquitously upholded by the student body.
Blasting the speaker in a room for 3 hours with the class wouldn't be a peaceful protest. That would be like damn near harassment. That's why we don't want to draw the line right here, right now. But I think, yeah.
And, you know, I would say that I think where there may be a little muddling of the line is the difference between civil disobedience and a peaceful protest. You know, peaceful protesting, I think one would assume when you think of a peaceful protest, a reasonable person is thinking it's usually held within a public space. It's students holding their signs and being in a place where all students are allowed to publicly be at all times. Now, classrooms, are not that location. And so if a student were to go in there to disrupt class time, yes, it could be quote unquote peaceful, but it wouldn't really count as like a peaceful protest. It would be more of a civilly disobedient act because it is not a public space that the student is allowed at that time. And while one could consider it a type of protest, that level of disruption is not what is usually sought after when individuals are trying to protest, especially if you are trying to culminate numbers. It's just very hard to mobilize individuals to disrupt private classroom sessions.
First, I just want to say, I think it's kind of dangerous for a group of undergrads to try and carve out the lines of what is considered peaceful protest, what's acceptable. Because what is a protest if not subverting the norms to push against the status quo, right? And so I guess the alternative, what I'm seeing to what you're asking for, when we like, you know, to define peaceful protest is a laundry list of acceptable nonviolent forms of protest. I think that while that is a concern that I acknowledge that you might have, we need to zoom out and focus on the broader implication of the fact that, like, when we allow admin to punish students for any form of peaceful protest, it sets a precedent, right? That anyone in the future across any political spectrum can now be suppressed in any form of peaceful protest. So I think I really want to reiterate that as the biggest, like, as one of the big goals of the resolution. And yeah.
Thank you. Representative Parikh, do you have an amendment?
Yes, I do have the amendment. Okay. So I move to strike lines 46 and 47 and insert in line 32, whereas students are currently protesting for the university to respect the results of a referendum that was approved by a majority of the student body.
That amendment is in order. Is there a second?
Yeah, sorry. So in line 32, insert, whereas students are currently protesting for the university to respect the results of a referendum that was approved by a majority of the student body.
Second.
There's a second. Is there any dissent to that amendment? Seeing none, that is ordered. Okay, are there any?
Yeah. I got it. I can email it to you.
Okay. Representative Florida, have you spoken yet?
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Barry?
In line, I guess, with my previous question, I think this is just, you know, I'm open to discussion. That's why I bring it up because, you know, I'd love to hear your guys' opinions on it. But like coming in to student assembly, I knew that the majority of the student body doesn't really know what we do, except that sometimes we do put out opinion pieces that equate to nothing in reality. It's more of like a lip service thing. So like just coming in, I kind of am not that for a lot of lip service. Oh, look, us as a board that got elected by 15 to 23% of the student body, say a thing on hopefully behalf of the student body. And I just don't really feel like it serves anything. Like I get the feeling and the emotion behind it, but, like, how do you guys feel about like that angle coming at this thing?
Yeah, I get what you're saying, actually, and I somewhat agree because it is a sense of the body, of a sense of body. Would you be open?
Parliamentary inquiry. Given the content of this resolution, what are the other possible types of resolution that we could classify this as?
It's just sense of the body.
It could, like, not be a recommendation, like a regular resolution?
No, I think it's just sense of the body because it's not making any specific... I guess it is
making specific claims, actually. So that's why I feel like it's more so...
You can, I mean, that is not technically part of the resolution, so you can change that if you want. If you want to just change the recommendation, it's whatever you... I mean, I think it would fall under either category.
Yeah, I think
it gets sent to the president's office regardless, just like the difference in wording on that.
Representative Barry, I think that's a really valid concern, especially when looking at the feasibility of it. I think what's really important to reconcile with is that all of us here have the ability to write resolutions like this. We have a direct means to get our message across to admin, and we would be simply remiss to not take this opportunity in a time where it's dire. So, you know, it doesn't matter. We're not doing this so that, you know, we have great optics for the student body. but you know, we still need to be serving our community in whatever way we have.
And I just wanted to respond really quickly. I agree with what you're saying, but I do take a lot of pride in myself that I could be wrong, but I'm going to say that I have confidently only co-sponsored resolutions where students have come to me asking for them. And so if there are students that feel like it's lip service, they weren't the ones that were asking for it. And so, you know, when students come to me and they have issues, I like to put them forward. So that's where I feel confident that it's not lip service, because it was an ask by student body.
Thank you.
Yeah, just to reiterate that, like, there are like over 20 student organizations who co-sponsor this resolution because they're passionate about it and they want to see it passed by the student body. So there is a sizable amount of the student population who feel like it's important.
Thank you. Representative Akaraju, and then I'm going to call a question on this
I just wanted to reiterate all the points that were just said. I just want it to be abundantly clear that I don't really think that the things at Student Assembly are performative, and I do see that there is an impact on the student body when we do things, even if it is just for making a statement. For example, we saw this in our elections this year. Most of us sitting here actually didn't even run for our seats and just got them. But this year, almost every single one of the positions was highly contested. And it shows that the student body really, really cares about Student Assembly's attachment to a lot of the issues that we've been discussing this year. So I just want to put it out there. If there is a sentiment that you're voting based on thinking that it doesn't matter how you vote, I actually would argue that it very much does matter how we vote and the resolutions that we are discussing, because the student body really, really does care. So I just want to make sure there's no sentiment that this is unimportant or that it's, you know, lippy by any means.
Thank you. I'm going to call the question on this. All those in favor of this resolution, please raise your placards at this time. All those opposed? Congratulations, that passes unanimously. Are you opposed? Okay, all those, congratulations, that passes unanimously. We will now move to resolution 75, and I will cede the chairship. That is an order. There's a motion on the floor to extend time to 7:15.
Second.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any dissent?
Two order.
Seeing none. Point of information.
Point of information.
So there's 275s in the box.
We have to renumber a whole bunch of resolutions anyway, so it's probably an issue now, but we'll fix it afterwards.
I apologize. The first one we were addressing is establishing the Student Assembly Campus Pulse Committee and addressing transparency issues.
Point of inquiry?
Point of inquiry.
Like, what is the general like synopsis of what we're about to do next? Like, what has to be done in the next like 15, 20 minutes?
I have to present both of these resolutions.
About like the 74 again? I thought we did that.
75. Establishing the Student Assembly Campus Pulse Committee and addressing transparency issues.
Oh, okay.
Hello, everybody. Super weird to be on this side of the table. Okay, I will try to make this quick today, because both of these resolutions will be brought up again as a third reading at the next assembly meeting. These are really important, and I have spent a bunch of time on them, so I appreciate your feedback both while I'm presenting today, but also if you have any thoughts throughout this next week on ways that this resolution could be improved or other things that I'm missing, please reach out and please let me know your thoughts. I want to make this as progressive and impactful as possible. So resolution 75, establishing the Student Assembly Campus Pulse Committee and addressing transparency issues. I will summarize the whereas clauses and kind of the auspice for creating this resolution. I think we had a lot of failures this year, and those have been pretty significantly expressed at the Student Assembly meeting. I think that we need to be doing better as an institution. We need to be supporting each other more, and we need to be supporting the community more. I recognize that for sure. And I think that there's a lot that we can do to be better. So that is the auspice of this resolution.
I think there's a significant amount of things that converged this semester, which made it difficult for both those in the room and our campus community. But I will run through what this resolution does. It's a bylaw change, which will add a couple different really, I think, impactful things. The first one is it will give every single byline organization an ex officio seat on the student assembly. So they will be able to have members here to be able to communicate what they need and what's going on with their organizations, just as we can appoint people to their boards. And so it'll pretty significantly expand the size of the student assembly with non-voting members, but I think it will be impactful in terms of creating an open and transparent environment. So that's the first part. The second thing, and this would be the first whereas clause. This is a bylaw change which will require mandatory anti-bias and transparency training for every single new student assembly member who joins the student assembly starting next year. I have five different categories currently, A, B, C, and D, and E, which I felt were important. The first one, recognizing implicit bias. This is based off the UCLA Office of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Standards. They have a video series, which I think is really important. And very well done, which I think should be the standard of what every student assembly member is trained to, as a part of the training. The second is the importance of diversity in the work of the student assembly. I think we represent incredibly diverse communities as a student assembly, and sometimes it goes unnoticed, just how broad our campus community is. And I think that helping student assembly members when they come in, both in leadership roles and just representative roles, helping them understand how diverse our community is and how we can best represent that is really important. The third is working with stakeholders, and just, you know, that means members of the campus community, but also admin, and how you get in contact with admin, how you work with organizations, how you get in touch, what's a good way to recognize stakeholder values and good way to understand the stakeholders at play. The fourth is methods to increase relationships and transparency with the Cornell community. I had envisioned this to be something along the lines of, this is how you can do more tabling. This is how you can make your committee meetings more transparent. Things along those lines. And then the fifth, the proper channels for reporting of bias and harassment at the assembly level through the Office of Ethics and the university level through CCS and Title IX. I think it's really important that new assembly members who come in, if they have a concern, they understand where to go and how to deal with those concerns. I think that was one of the big failings on my part this year, that I didn't do an adequate job at helping all of you, but also informing myself on what to do when there were difficult situations that we needed to deal with on the student assembly. And then failure to complete mandatory training is grounds for removal from the assembly. The third part of this, and the largest part of this resolution, is the creation of something called the Campus Pulse Committee. I've been working with Shura Gatt in the Office of Gender Equity, the Gender Equity and Resource Center, excuse me. She's been fantastic, and I've also been working with PPGA on this. Basically, what the CPC will be is it will be funded through a $400,000 allocation into an endowed account, which will put out about 4% return a year, between 4 and 6%. So it's about between $25,000 and $35,000 a year to do increased programming for the needs of the Cornell community at that current point in time. I think that one of the big things that I realized as we've gone through this incredibly socially volatile time on campus is that there's the immediate impact of something that's happening on campus and students needing resources to deal with that. But what often goes unnoticed is there's secondary stakeholders that resources are reallocated from. So there are all these students that have been left hanging out to dry because their resources have been reallocated to deal with the current things happening on campus. And I don't think that should happen. So ideally, in my mind, this will provide some amount of padding to be able to address resources to a specific need at a specific time for issues that we can't even comprehend that will happen on this campus in the next, you know, 20 to 50 years or longer. So the Campus Pulse Committee will be significantly diverse in its membership. It'll have four elected representatives of the student assembly at large, plus the women's issues liaison of the student assembly, the LGBTQIA plus representative of the student assembly, the president of Haven or their designee, the president of the Interfaith Council or their designee, the president of Alana or their designee, the president of GJAC or their designee, two community members as chosen and appointed by the student assembly by application of the committee, one representative of the dean of students office, one representative of Cornell Health, and one and the director of the Gender Justice and Inclusivity Center as a voting member. So I have a list of charges here, which you should feel free to read, but basically the idea is that they will be increasing programming on campus to do anti-bias trainings and address the needs of the Cornell community at that current time. I'd like to see them work with the Intergroup Dialogue Project, and then this committee will also put on the anti-bias trainings for the student assembly members every year. And then the final thing that this resolution will do will be it'll allocate immediately $8,000 to their operations account to do three things for as their first three charges for next year. The first is the implementation of date rape drug test kits in and around the Cornell Ithaca campus. The second is increased financial support and programming for consent education courses on the Cornell Ithaca campus. And the third is increased cross-cultural dialogue projects to recognize our shared humanity as a Cornell community. So that's the nuts and bolts of the resolution. And I'm happy to take any questions. And again, if there's any suggestions, please send them my way, both here now and in the following week so that I can incorporate them before the meeting next Thursday.
Thank you for that, President Kuehl. Before we start off, I just wanted to touch base about point number one on the second to last be it further resolved clause, namely the part about implementing date rape drug test kits. So in my previous year, this was actually one of my first initiatives. There were issues that arose with like just the drink test strips and then with the retroactive ones. There was like another means as well. Did you have something in mind for like specific implementation?
Yeah, so I talked to Shira about this. What their thoughts were that is should be kind of left up to figure out what the committee thinks is best for the Cornell community. I wanted to be very careful to make sure that this was like a sound resolution and structure without pigeonholing the committee into this is exactly what you have to do, and for them to be able to say this is what is best for the Cornell community, this is what we need. I think that we talked about some different options. There's both date rape drug test kits, but then they offered as an alternative there are some preventative measures too, like drink covers and different things that could be implemented as an alternative if the committee sees that that is a better alternative. So I wanted to keep it relatively broad for them to analyze what they thought was best, but I'm definitely open to suggestions that people think we should change that to something more specific.
Yeah, thank you for that. I just want to share like a word of caution that a lot of the tech on the drink test kits are not FDA approved, which is it explains why there's a general hesitancy and why we haven't gotten them despite it being pennies per strip. And it might open us up to some liabilities, but I definitely think that this is a great idea and we should continue like pushing forward with like retroactive ones and working with the Pulse Committee to do so. Trustee Swenson.
Patrick, great job. My question is about the money. So you're trying to move $400,000 from the SAFC reserve account to this committee's fund, but then my question is there a limit to the amount that this committee can use per year, right? You say $8,000 can be used. But is that a limit per year for this specific committee?
No. So because it's an endowed account, there won't be any return on investment the first year of operation. So you put the $400,000 in this year, and then it takes the year to be able to utilize the return on investment that is put into the endowment account. So that's why I thought it was important to put the $8,000. I would have liked to put up to the amount that we would expect from return on investment, but like, to be perfectly frank, we don't have the financial capability to allocate $25,000 to next year's programming.
Thank you. Representative Barry.
First, well, two questions. The second one is related to JP's question, but the first one is, so the first point of expanding the amount of non-voting members on the assembly, what's your estimate of how many students that might be being added? And then also my only concern with that is like, of course, it makes sense for certain non-voting members to be on assembly because they're directly to like report something specific to us on a regular basis versus a lot of organizations obviously
are always welcome to come and ask us questions or present or talk or discuss with us. So I don't understand maybe your feeling of why it's a necessity to just immediately add a member.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that what we've seen with ex officios is there's some organizations that have assigned seats that don't use them. And I expect that that would be the same with these new ex officio seats. We obviously have some ex officio organizations, which assign someone very religiously every year, you know, our veterans representative. Every single year they have someone here, and very solidly. I think it's more about the availability of being able to actually have that person to come and have a voice in assembly meetings. Cause currently, you know, you have a byline organization which can come and present on the resolution they're talking about or something like that, but we don't have any codified rules that actually allows them to have a seat at the table and have a voice in the conversation, even though we are making decisions that directly affect their organization. We have, I think, 31 byline accounts. So, but not all of those will have seats. Like, for example, one of those is like New York Times. They won't have. That's not a student organization. And so I think that it will be good to, and there are also organizations that have more at stake with our process than others, right? Like CUMS, for example, you know, they might have some things that they want to talk to the assembly about, but most of the stuff that we deal with here is not germane to their operation. However, GJAC and Haven, we deal with a lot of things that are directly related to what they're trying to do on our campus. And so I think that having the availability for everyone to have a voice and everyone to have a seat on the assembly, I think, is really important. We might need to set up the room a little differently, but.
And sorry, I kind of didn't get to put the secondary question in there. I just want a clarification. Okay. Did I hear right? $400,000 getting moved somewhere?
That's for endowment? Correct. Yep.
All right. I'm still unclear about like how much money assembly has and whatever, and then where they're allowed to move it and how all that operates. But yeah, 400,000 sounds like a lot, because I heard like 500,000 was in our savings or whatever we have. So like we're moving like a majority into this committee.
So we have access to a portion of the SAFC's reserve accounts, which rolled over from COVID. This is not even close to the amount of money that can be pulled out of that. And I also wanted to make sure that the assembly next year has access to some of those funds. Those are not funds that will be accessible forever. They will get used in one way or another, which is why I like the idea of an endowed account. This will be something we do now, and we will never have to increase funding or give them more money ever again, because the endowment will continually be putting out money for them to use, kind of like SAIFC has every year. SAFC has between like $75,000 and $90,000 from an endowed account, which they use to fund infrastructure projects on campus. We don't have to give them more money every year. We don't have to increase our byline allocation to them. They have an endowed account, which lets them do that. And so this is the same pool of money that we pulled Slope Day funding out of last year, earlier this year, and also probably where we will end up after we do some small transfers around getting some of the money for other initiatives like the BSU trip. This year, after we just kind of move some things around. But yeah, we do not, our student assembly reserve account does not have $400,000 in it.
Representative Borna, you're recognized.
Just one question in regards to the people that would be on the committee and like voting and non-voting members. Because on here, you have like one representative of the Dean of Students as a voting member, but the as a voting member isn't with the other, any of the other organizations. And so I'm just curious, like, are all members that are on the committee going to be voting members or any some?
Yes. So all I can absolutely, thank you for that clarification. I'll absolutely add as a voting member to each of these. In my mind, on some of our other committees, it is implied when you have a member of administration on a committee that they are not a voting member. So that's why I wanted to make it clear. As I talked to members of administration, they felt like in order to make sure that this was sustainable and reoccurring operation that, you know, staff members wanted to engage in, even if they didn't have a majority of votes, they should still be able to engage constructively and feel like they have a voice in the process. This has been really successful with the dining committee, which is one of our committees that operates relatively independently, but does do really important work. Like they're doing all of the Starbucks transition stuff. And we have representation on that, but also staff members in the dining services have representation on that, and they have voices and votes.
Also, is the women's representative supposed to have an X?
It is. Thank you for noting that.
Representative Almeida.
Just to double check, this would be adding seats to the assembly and not like replacing any or taking any seats off.
Yep, it would be just adding seats. And they would be ex officio seats, so there wouldn't be voting representatives. They would be vocal representatives, kind of like you are currently, the white placards. Yep.
Trustee Swenson?
Yeah. I think Franklin brings up a good point about adding more members to the assembly. Given the fact that we have such a large assembly as it is somewhat inefficient, given we have so many voices, but it is important. And I think adding more people who aren't elected by the student assembly, in the sense that it is an ex officio, kind of sets that precedent. You know, I'm an ex officio member, but I was elected by the students, so therefore I feel inclined to speak on the students' behalf and as well as my own. But I think adding more people to the assembly as ex officio members is kind of, leads them like, just, in my sense, it's inefficient. It also brings in the question about like executive session topics like that. Like I was invited to the executive session, you were as well, right? But if we have members who weren't elected by the assembly attending these sessions and they're speaking behalf, of the student body, but they're not elected, I think it sets a bad precedent. So I'm going to push back on the fact that we should add more, ex officio members to this assembly.
Thank you. I appreciate that perspective. I really do. I just don't agree with you. I think that, you know, in some senses, elected people should have voices and votes. But that doesn't mean you don't represent the community if you're in a leadership role in one of the most like major funding organizations on this campus. Like we historically have had extremely poor contact with our byline organizations because the only time we see them is once every 2 years when they come in to give their appropriations presentation. And I think that that is wrong. And I think it needs to change.
That, and I think that, you know, nothing really changes, honestly. It's just like a change in name of inviting bylines to have an ex officio seat. Like technically in our charter or one of our governing documents, any community member, including like staff, faculty, Cornell student, is afforded debate privileges as an ex officio member. I think putting this out in name creates a sense of responsibility for the bylines to be more involved in the shared governance system.
Definitely. And I would just clarify that that clause no longer exists in our charter because it was non-functional. So I think that this helps include more people, which is what I think we should always be doing.
Representative Akiraju?
Oh, I was just going to make the quick point that if they do represent certain byline organizations, then also inherently they were elected by the group that they represent. So even though it wasn't the entire general student body that might have elected them into that position, those organizations still elected those people to represent them if they are serving in leadership roles. So like, for example, if you're involved in any club on campus and you become president, right, your entire club voted for you to become president. So I think it's a different form of election, but it still is an election in some sense.
Representative Flournoy.
On that note, I'd only ask that, could we put, I don't know, could you put, I guess I'd have to figure out what the clause is, but, for the member that is added to be like an e-board member or something, because by virtue of like the way that it's written right now, anyone of like any organization, like any byline could be that representative. And I think that it's a good point that like the people should be elected, to some extent. Like whether it's the entirety of the school has opportunity or just the organization. But I think that that is important that the people that are here are elected in some capacity.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to make that change. And we don't need to make that amendment right now because I can just do it again next week.
Representative Vinson, you're recognized. Can you please speak in the mic?
Yeah. Something I'm wondering, I do think that the byline organization should have a say inside the assembly process, but I also understand the concern of adding a lot of seats. Is it possible to give them seats on various sort of committees? So, for example, like the environmental committee or the academic policy committee, like would that make sense?
I mean, people are always welcome to join committees. You don't have to be.
It's more like giving them an assigned seat. Like you can send a person. And elect someone from your club to be on.
Yeah, I mean, again, like an organization has full right to be able to do that regardless of our bylaws. Like if they just want to elect someone to go and serve on a committee, that's fine. Or multiple people from their organization, but you can't do that for the student assembly.
Motion to end debate.
Yeah, so we're in the second reading calendar, I believe, so there is no ending debate. But if there are no more comments on the floor, President Keel, feel free to transition into your next resolution.
Thank you so much. This will be my final word on the assembly, which we will get here again next week, and I still need to clean up this resolution just a tad. But this is a conversation that I've been involved in, but also Vice President Ting has been involved in with the Dean of Students Office to provide free bus shuttle service to the Syracuse and Ithaca airport after finals, so that people can get to their planes without having to pay $100 for an Uber. So this is, I think, beneficial. We estimated high at $18,000 because, the exact schedule of everyone's flights and the number of students that are going to sign up is, you know, obviously yet to be determined because students will need to sign up. So it probably won't be $18,000, but we wanted to just make sure that there would be enough there. So this would be from the reserve accounts. It would cut into the reserve accounts a little bit, which will leave slightly less money for next year. But I think we also, for this very reason, raise the allocation that student assembly receives every year to make sure that it's feasible for us to do programming like this in the future, which is what I think we should be doing as an organization. That's one of the things I've been advocating for. So yeah, other than that, it's a pretty simple resolution. I think it'll be 4 trips to Syracuse at the main flight times that students have. There will be a bus that leaves Cornell at 2 a.m. to make the 5:30 flight out of Syracuse to New York City. And then there will also be a bus shuttle service to the Ithaca Airport.
I also want to say this is like the most direct means that we can do to like help the community. I feel like this is like the kind of stuff that side chat eats up because it's the most tangible, and it's the most helpful. Representative Height, you're recognized.
Hi, I know you said like you weren't like finished with it or anything, but like one like really quick thing. I know that you said like it's like first come, like first serve or whatever. Would you be open to like making it so some way that like low income students could like have first access or like priority to it somehow?
Yeah, I want to do that. I'm not, and I could absolutely talk to the Dean of Students Office about it. I'm not sure how to make that feasible to implement. And there could be something I'm not saying. It'll be done through campus groups. So you sign up on campus groups, and I don't know enough about campus groups to know if you can get like special designee status as a low income student on there. But happy to ask the Dean's office about it and see if we can figure out how to make that work. We've been working very closely with them on this project.
Trustee Swenson, you're recognized.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I don't see the purpose in giving people a free bus pass who can already afford that bus pass pretty sufficiently. I mean, this should be directed equitably to people who can't afford it. And if we're just handing out money to people who already have the money to pay for a bus pass, I think that's a waste. So if this can't be implemented in an equitable manner where low-income students who are having trouble paying for a bus pass aren't going to be receiving the bus pass, then, you know, we're helping students, but we should be allocating funds to those who really need it.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there is the secondary concern outside of the financial stuff that for those like 5:30 a.m. flights, there's literally not transportation available at all, period, bar none, hands down. So I think that's the other consideration in my mind. Like, it is about, you know, implementing this equitably, but it's also about providing access, period. And I think that we have had discussions about being able to scale up the amount of seats provided depending on how many students sign up. So we might have to approve more funding later if this is like, you know, thousands of students sign up. I don't think that's going to be what happens, but we'll see.
Vice President Parikh.
Yeah, I mean, thank you guys for doing this. This is like a really great idea. I think the one thing my question is that, do you guys have plans to like make sure that it's not at the same times as the hour bus, or like somehow staggered it where like the time, like as you were saying, like the 5:30 a.m. one, right? Or like other times like that where the hour bus is not operating and where buses are needed.
Yeah, we looked at the hour bus schedule and filled the holes, basically, is what we did.
I guess kind of on that too, I'm personally curious about who's responsible for coordinating like the logistics of this.
Yeah, so the bus company will do the logistics. We already have, and I don't have it in front of me, and it'll be for you at the next meeting when this officially gets voted on. But we have a full schedule with, you know, the times that people are picked up. And I've been working with Jessica and the Dean of Students Office about, you know, these are the times when people need to be picked up to get to Syracuse in time and Ithaca in time. And here are the convenient locations where the bus can pick people up, Baker Flagpole, North Campus. Different locations like that. So, both the Dean of Students Office, but like, I think a lot of it actually is handled by the bus company in terms of figuring out what needs to be where and when. And then, both campus activities, myself, the Dean of Students Office have been working with campus groups to figure out exactly how the implementation is going to get rolled out. And then, people in the communications department at SCL that I've talked to have offered to help us communicate, more broadly with the campus population. And I will also send a press release out to the Sun when this is passed, if this is passed.
Love to hear. Representative Flournoy?
Is this just for this semester?
Yes. Yeah, so we're approving the funds for this semester. If this is something that is successful, I would recommend that all of you who are returning consider re-implementing it next year.
All right. If there are no further comments, I will recede the chair to President Kiel.
Thank you. We do have one more point on our calendar. I would contest whether this is actually something we have to have on the agenda, but it was important to members of this assembly, so I'm going to raise it. We do still have to discuss Vice President Letterman's removal from his seat on the student assembly. So I would personally just call the question to vote on his removal. We don't have enough people here though, so we can't even do that. So with that in mind, we don't have enough people here. We don't have 2/3 of the assembly to vote to remove, even if everyone here voted to remove him from his seat.
Yeah, point of information. I thought, didn't we do a vote?
We voted to remove him from his office,
but not his seat.
So he retained his office, but we still have to consider his seat, but we cannot do that right now because we don't have 2/3 of the voting membership present. So that will be transferred over to the last agenda of the semester. And Vice President Letterman, do you have a point or motion?
I am going to move that we table that indefinitely, given that we only have one more meeting left, suspend indefinitely, excuse me.
Is there any dissent to that motion?
Parliamentary, is that even possible to have a non-2/3 vote on something that revolves a 2/3 vote?
What? Oh my god!
Because this is a motion to remove, this can be made at any time if someone feels really strongly about bringing it up next meeting. That's totally fine. You're totally welcome to do that. That motion is in order. There was a second. Is there any dissent to tabling that motion indefinitely so it does not appear on the next calendar? Seeing none, that is in order. I would move that we adjourn our second last student assembly meeting of the year.
Wait, question. Are we swearing in the new members next meeting?
So yeah, this is actually a good point. So what we're going to do is we're going to meet next week at a regular meeting time. All of you who are reelected will also get an email from Mr. Ram, the president-elect.
Yeah.
Basically saying that you will do your swearing in ceremony and your election of officers after the conclusion of our final student assembly meeting on Thursday. I will personally be going to CTB after the student assembly meeting for anyone who wants to come with me and drinking a cold beer. So you are all.
Yeah.
And then new members are of course welcome after if you can't obviously drink if you're under 21, but, yeah. Sorry, Christian. So anyways, motion to adjourn. There's a second.
Second.
Also, Vice President Tang.
Also, shout out to Luke for completing the election. 23%. That's outstanding.
The time is 7:14. This meeting is adjourned.
True.
I think we're just.